Hello, everybody. Welcome to the new bonus episodes, or the bonus series, for the second season. I attended the Costa Rican Big Data School, and, you know, I thought that maybe some of you can take some value out of this. You know, many aspiring computer scientists and software engineers would really benefit from the things that they talk about in this event. This was a five-day event from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, so it was pretty extensive, and they talked about a lot of different subjects and, you know, very important things that you got to know in this day and age with big data and data science and data analysis. So I thought, you know what? I'll put this up. Maybe some of my listeners can take advantage of this and can benefit from listening to really, really high-end professors from the Texas Advanced Computing Center. So our instructors will be Wei-Ya Xu. He's a PhD and the group lead for Data Mining and Statistics Group. Prior to joining TAC, he obtained a master's degree in biological sciences and a doctoral degree in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. Then there's also Charlie Day. Charlie Day is the Director of Training and Professional Development with the User Services Group at TAC, with a background in web development and scientific computing. Charlie's responsibilities at TAC include organizing, developing content, and building curriculums for TAC's academic course selection taught in conjunction with several departments at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as for TAC's professional development and educational team. Oh, well. Oh, and just a quick thanks to Danny Xie, who was the one who recorded these segments. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome bonus round. So thank you very much, and enjoy.
Can anyone tell me what the things missing from this picture comparing to the picture of supervised learning? Yes? Yes, very good. So the label was missing. Right, so recall for the supervised learning, for the training data side, we have the data, and we also have the labels, and go through selections, and go through machine learning algorithms, generating models. But for the, so that's what we call the supervised, because the model will be supervised by the label, which is a reflection of how people label the data, how people think the data should be. So when I'm also asking the question and emphasize the question, what are we learning, right? So in the supervised learning method, what we are learning is how people actually label the data. We are trying to learn a way that we can explain why given this set of data values, they should be assigned with these labels here, okay? We call that. But here, since we do not have a label here, so what we are trying to learn here, what's the purpose of unsupervised learning? Anyone? Trying to score the class for the data? Trying to like find a way to finding the grouping of the data? That's the thing. Yes? That's good.
To find a pattern without a hypothesis.
Yes, that's another good way to describing them. So both of you actually talk about the same thing. It's even without the labels, and we can still try to learn if there's any natural groupings within the data or any patterns from the data. So what unsupervised learning really want to learn, want to really get out, or what the model will reflect is the structure embedded in your data. So it's trying to just, given this training data set, we want to uncover what type of grouping is there, or if there are some repeated patterns or some repeated values we want to be able to use. And also, it's not just like a structure groupings, and there's a lot of like a different type of things we can learn from it. In the last part, in the bottom part of the slides, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to mapping some common method or task you heard about, like clustering, and what it exactly is doing in the unsupervised learning sphere. So clustering is a method that trying to find the groupings in your data set and is trying to assign the membership to it. And the association analysis is another form of unsupervised learning. It's trying to find the connection or inference among your instance as well. Then we have a method like the Gaussian mean-term model. So what they're trying to do is trying to learn what's the density distribution of your data. And those maybe sounds strange or foreign for you right now, but hopefully after I go through the next several slides, we can make that plan maybe the more clear. And also we have the method in unsupervised learning that can try to give you a different representation of your data. So those are very important things, and those are the things I do want you to maybe keep in mind when you have an actual problem you want to think about. What's your goal? Whether you want to find a group or whether you want to find another alternative representation of your data, then you can go looking and select the appropriate method to use. Okay? So I won't be able to have the time to go detail with all of those. We'll start with the learning of the data representations, because this is actually I got several questions about how you pre-processing data and how you get redundant data or how you get without correlation among your data. So one of the approach people can use is through the principal component analysis. So technically, principal component analysis is a linear algebra transformation. It transforms your input matrix into into another form. So in the machine learning scope, it's often being viewed as a data transformation method. So here is just very, very abstract view. If you think about your data set by some type of linear form of multi variables, and you can express them as the first equations perfectly. Right? There might be like likely existing another solution that can also describe your data. Right? It could be the same dimension or it could be different dimension. So that's the kind of the core, like simplest ideas inside the principal component analysis is a data transformation. We are trying to find another way to describing the data. Okay? So the potential usage of that is to help you to visualize data, and some question about the noise filtering. So this is a good way to help you to filter out some noise and do the feature selections. Okay, so let's see what's about the change data representations about. Right? So the first one, the next slide, I'm going to show you a couple of pictures. The first one is a set of the two-dimensional points. So that's again is being randomly generated. The code you can find in my unsupervised learning Python notebook as well. You can try them yourself. Then the second picture you see in the right now, in addition to the points, now you see two arrows here. Right? So one is along this line, it's somewhat seems like a regression line, so we put up before. But then you have an orthogonal to these lines that have another small vectors out. So what those two try to show is actually the first two components of a singular value decompositions of your original data matrix. So that's some of the fancy mathematical terms, but let me just ask you, what do you think these two vectors reflect? What are these two vectors trying to show or trying to represent? So those, we plot in our data in a coordinate systems, right? So when we plot in our random generated data in the first pictures, and we're using a coordinate system like this. And what these two components trying to show you is actually the top two components that can basically to say along which vectors your data is being distributed out, your value is being distributed out. So if we just look at this one, it's easier to understand that our regression line. So it's basically saying our data is more likely to distribute it near around this line that way. So the second line is to show how the second smaller components to this, and then it's to show not only our value tends to distribute along this line, they are not perfectly form one line, everything on that line exactly, but we are also distributed a little bit out to those things as well. So that's what those two components, two vectors try to show. It's two dominant directions where your data is distributed along, okay? So with that, what we can do is, what if we don't use the current coordinate system to show those data, but instead we use a coordinate system along these two lines, and maybe scaling to those vectors and to show the data, then we will get this, right? So this is the same set of data points and just under a different kind of combination systems. Okay. So this is same set of data, and this is the same set of data between here and here. And what it does is what I mean by change of the data representations. So the first one is it's one way you map your data into, and on the second one is another dimension or another space you are projecting your data into there. Okay. So why this is important to us is you can see here, you may think about the data is more linear correlated, right? So that may not be a good thing, right? When you do it, you may say, oh, let's just using one dimensional guide without the other. But if you think about as a principal component, when you ask you to do decompositions, the data seems like more evenly distributed in that space. So that might be better for you to using some other method to do the classification, right? So if you think your method being heavily affected by the collinearities, and then if you do a projection to a different space, you think that more uniform distribute, you can actually using the same method that doesn't work before with this new representations, that actually may work better. And then you get, because they are exactly the same data size, so you can get in the same type of class labels there. Okay. That, any questions? Any thoughts? So this one is just to say we only use the first dimensions that we draw within the original coordinate system where we just highlighting is more like the linear regression lines what we get here. Okay. You should be able to try this with a notebook, I think. Let me see if I do have that. So again, the unsupervised learning is a different notebook here. Let's see if it's working. So the first one is some plotting functions, and then the next block is principal components and analysis, where I'm generating a data set. Here I didn't generate the data set here. It's using the Bryce tensor data set. So where you can see how the two class of the Bryce tensor data can be distributed along the two principal components. So that makes them seem like more separate of occupying different areas. So now actually, since we can run this now, the other thing is, it's the same data set I've been using since supervised learning method as well. So this is the same breast cancer data set. This is the decision boundaries and how classify those data with two dimensions from the original vectors. So where you see the data is more scattered around, and maybe have different class anywhere. Where once we do the principal component analysis, they may be better separated by the first two dimensions there. Okay. So that's the type of things you can explore. So I have a slide that talk about a little more about the two data sets we were using there for the breast cancer data set. From two classes, and there's over 500 observations. For each class, there are 30 feature vectors. you can use them for enterprise learning like this. I'm trying to see how principal component or other method do that mapping and the projections. Or you can use it as a testing, experimenting different supervisor learning method as well. I also had the visualization for the iris data size, so that's a data size we use in some other examples. It's a smaller one about different flowers. It kind of comes with the three classes there. So other than say using the principal components as a way to generating a different representation of your data, so it maybe works better. And the principal component itself can be a very good way to help you to pre-process your data. So a common usage of the principal component is I heard people asking about anomalies and noise points in the data side, and those, if they are present allowed, they might be affect your accuracy of your other method, other analysis method. So principal component is also a good way to help you to get rid of the noise. So how it can achieve that is go back what exactly the principal component does and how it reflects. Since I skipped the mathematical detail slides, so it's a little bit harder for me to explain that correctly here, but we call the function we have. So basically the principle is that we're assuming our data may be described by certain linear functions, then we are finding another solution trying to describe that, right? So in this case, we can call the new solution, each of the dimensions as the new components there. And so what each of those new components there means is they are contributing to the explanation of part of our variance we can observe from our original data set, like how we are distributing. If you add the notebooks, I actually had a nice example trying to show this. It's a nice one called explain the variance of the PCA. So what this one does is we load in the data set, and we try to use the PCA components. And what we can say is in this case, we are, so we have a certain component out because the original feature vector has a certain features. Each data point has a certain dimensions. So the other principal components, we get the certain components out. But that is alternative representations of the original data. What this one says is this graph on the x-axis is the different components. On the y-axis is what we call the aggregated variance that can be explained by those components. What that means is say if you're using entirely 30 components, the solution you get should be pretty much exactly as your original solution. Now this is through a purely mathematical transformation, right? But if you do not use all the components in your alternative solutions, if you use first of them, you lose some of the variance you could explain. So which means we're introduce some type of errors or approximations. But in return, what we get is we can maybe focusing more on the component that either now belongs to noise or helps us to reduce the dimensionalities. So that is another important usage of the principal component, is help you to picking up or subset of the components you want to use, either to reduce the complexities, make the method more useful, or as a way to filter out the noise. So go back to the slides. There's examples in the code as well. So we have original data from the scan of the handwritings of the digits. So there's 0, 1, 2 there. And we have we can add in additional noise on there. So you see we can add in more of the 5 pixels in there. And then we can run the principal components. And only using, we can select what's a subset of components we want to use and to reconstruct a data point. Since we only choose the dominant component, so some of the noise components in the later, we expect in the later are going to be automatically excluded from the generated data there. Okay? Yes.
As an example, when these are new exons, or
is an example.
In this example, the components are the fixes.
Yes, it's a pixels, right? So let me see the code. So I have more example for using a different data type and here we have the input data, and the input data is from another built-in data type with those built-in digits, like those are the actual digit scans, and each a very small. Bitmaps. So you use each bitmap entirely as the input vectors. So when you do the PCAs, you get the entire the vectors out as well. But those are corresponding, as you said, is each individual pixels here. Then if, like, say, this is the original shapes, it's almost 1800 times 64. So you have 1800. The image and the 64 is each vector. So each of those is 8x8 small pixels on the character to that. And then we have PCA components and being generated. And then we have the filter the shapes and the after we like any noise and then we try to get rid of those. Okay. So some quick summaries, the PCA is it's a way for you to finding a alternative representations of your data, and it can be used directly as a way to filter out some of noise from your data, or it can be used as a pre-processing steps, help you to do feature selections, so you only use a subset of attributes and to do that. There are some limitations and of the PCAs, so there are some other alternative methods as well. I don't have time to go through them, but some other common used method I also have example here, which is very interesting. Let's see, I have the next one is called the multi-dimensional scaling here. I don't have slides, so I don't plan to go through this, but I apply this to the same breast cancer data type. It's to a different type of projections with your data type, so not just the principal components. And I have another method later on, it's called another transformations that can be applied into the different cases here. So if you have time, please go ahead to try them and to see what they can get to you. So all three methods can give you alternative representation of your data. Any questions about this type of method, PCA and the the other type of the unsupervised learnings I want to introduce is about learning data structures, and those type of the tasks is usually being called as a clustering. So we want to say, given this data, we want to find out if we have a certain number of clusters or how my data might be grouping together, might be putting them together. The mostly commonly used one is probably the most popular one. It's called K-means clustering. So how many of you know this? K-means clustering algorithms? Yes, quite a few of them. So the idea is very simple. It's sort of like a K-nearest neighbors, right? So in this case, we do not have a neighbor, and we do not have a class labels, but we can still assign, say, if my data points existed in some space, then for each point, I want to find this kind of natural formation of them. So we start with a set of random points, assuming that's our final centers. Then for each one, we will calculate a distance between this point to all other points. Then we will assign for all other points, we will assign the group membership to the centers closest to it. So it's similar to the nearest neighbor, where for each point, we want to find its neighbors, and based on neighbors, to define this class label. And here is we start with a set of the assumed centers. Then we, for each data point, we find the closest center. Then we light that data to assume the membership of that centers. Okay. So they are all distance based, all based on instance. So there's a nice illustration about how that process does. So here, okay, it's a two-dimensional data, so I can talk to them for illustration purpose, but the same thing applies to the arbitrary dimensions as well. So what you are seeing here is a bunch of data points. Now you also see three big cross. So in this case, we want to do a k equals three clustering, so which means we are trying to find to see if our cluster, or we want to, the algorithm try to divide in our data into three groups, okay? So the first one doesn't really matter, we can just randomly generate the initial one, and then like the algorithm work itself, and iteratively, we generate the final result. So assuming this is the location of the initial centers we selected, then once we select them, we can pick any points and compute the distance from this point to the center one, center two, center three, whichever center is closest to, we will put them at the same group. For illustration purpose, I use the red, green, and blue to illustrate the three group memberships. Okay, so those are not ground truths for your class label. It's just at this iteration, if giving these three centers are the true center of my clusters, those are the group membership we will assign to. Okay? So this is iteration zeros. So once we have these iterations, does this look like a good grouping or good clustering result for you? No, right? So you feel like there's too much of them tangled together. So what happens with the algorithm is once we do this group membership assignment, we will recompute based on how many red points, how many green points, how many blue points. We can visually see those are not center for all the green points anymore. Those are not center for all the blue points anymore. This might be the center for the red, but who knows, right? So we do that, we can recompute what's the center under this assignment. So now what you get is you get a new set of centers, right? So you see the green one move down, the blue one move down, the red a little bit move down. Then when you get to a new center, you can go to the different calculation again and then assess the closeness between each point towards each of those centers. What the result is you get a different set of the cluster assignments as well. So you see there's more red groups and the less green, less blue. And we can continue this, and you see the center may be gradually move out under this iteration 4 and under this iteration 5. So here, it looks like more reasonable grouping of the clustering of the data, right? So after we do iteration 5 and iteration 6, it's pretty much there's no changing, so we know it reaches what we call the converging state, and then we'll stop the algorithms and we'll do generating those as output. Any questions or thoughts about this? Have any of you used the k-means clustering in the practice?
No.
So what's the number one problem with the k-means clustering?
Yeah, because starting points are random, sometimes see this like strange thing.
Yes. So the algorithm starts with a random start. So first of all, we start with the random points. So which means the algorithm each time it may actually generating a different result if we're applying a different type of starting points. So we have another example here is this is the same this set of data points, but the initial central selection are different. So you see the initial source house is different. If we go through the same process, at some point they actually stay there, they actually don't really change much. So you get a different set of the cluster representations are. So that's the thing with the k-means clustering is it's running really fast, it's really effective, and it can be done effectively in a distributed way, but the result is never going to be a global optimal result. It's always subject to your initial selections as methods. Based on different central selections, you may actually get a different result. Okay? So that's the number one thing. And what's the number two things you often feel? Yeah, exactly, the number of k's, right? So For the illustration, I'm just using number of k equal to 3. It might be reasonable, or maybe you can think about here, we should have a 4, 2 class, or 5. So there's a never a good way to say how many k's there is, okay? So the number of k selection and the initial sequence selection, putting them together, which means it's even k-means classing is a very good algorithm. It's not an algorithm as a classifier. So even you know, I expect the 3 clusters in my data. Running k-means algorithm 1,000 times may even not actually give you that perfect 3 clusters out, right? And sometimes it's very hard to control the centroid as well. So if you think you are very smart and you think I can pick the cluster center correctly at the first time, maybe you really can do that. Maybe you make one mistake that may be affecting result. So for this set of slides, what we have here is a comparison. So we have 10 clusters, and what we want to do is if we put in a different cluster in central selections, so the first, the one on the left, it seems worse because we have two centroid on one side, two centroid here, two centroid here, two centroid here, two centroid here. On the other side, so we have one here, one here, one here, one here. It's almost correct, except we are missing one here, but putting two of them here. So just from iteration one, you may think the one on the right is more correct than the others, right? But if you run multiple iterations, you think the final result is actually the opposite. And you get in the one left, they can actually converging into somewhat the optimal solutions, but the one on the left is basically trapped here, and they never be able to move out and kind of do something like that. Okay. So what does this tell you? How many of you think that don't use this method? It's so unreliable. So for the unsupervised learning, that's a big difference between unsupervised learning and supervised learning. Remember what you're trying to learn here is you're trying to learn the structure. So you apply the k-means clustering algorithm, regardless whether it's generating an optimal solution to you or not, you should get insights about how your data organized, whether or what type of structure that you embedded into there. So there's no say to the question of how we can choose best k for my problems, how we can choose the best set of centroids to my problems. There's a numerical method can help you evaluating clustering result. You can see which one is better. But ultimately, the unsupervised clustering method want to give you is one type of the structures that embedded on your data. So you need ultimately to inspect those structures to see that one. Which part of it makes sense, or whether it makes sense at all. Okay. more advanced or more used method is called bisecting k-means method. So instead of asking you the question about choosing k's, and you can actually using the bisecting k-means method doing a hierarchical clustering. So it's using a top-down clustering. It starts with one cluster and split the cluster into two. And until the process continues, until it reaches the desired k clusters you want or some other conditions. So this is take care of some of the problems, but doesn't make all the central selection or the randomness, take some of the randomness problems, but doesn't make other clustering limitations go away. But here, the good thing about this is that you may not only just get in a k-means clustering, but you also have chance to see a hierarchical structures of your data that might help you to understand these things better. I should have both examples in here. So this is a k-means clustering. I made some like random data sets, so make them like more easy to show what's the effect of each of those. And then, so the previous one is an easy case for k-means clustering to solve, because each cluster is very far away and very easy to do. And then there are some hard cases like this, where like you have this non-linear form or non-circular form. So which is something like really hard for k-mean type of the distance-based algorithm to solve. So yeah, just practice with this. Then there are more variety of the clustering algorithm. Like I mentioned, bisecting k-means give you a form of hierarchical clustering result out. There are also other methods trying to give you hierarchical clustering result out. And using those, sometimes you might get better result in some harder case where k-mean clustering cannot be resolved. Okay. So here's another way. If you're generating a hierarchical clustering result, you can generate an integral starting to visualizing how those clusters being hierarchically organized as well. So any questions about the learning embedded structures of your data using transfer learning method? So the last one I want to introduce is about learning, what we call learning data densities. So this is matched to another ideas of the doing clusterings or finding the structures. So recall in the k-means clusterings, the class membership was decided by the closeness or distance-based method, right? So we still need to assess the distance measures, and we still need to evaluate that. But like in the supervised clustering, the supervised method, we have a distance-based, like a linear-based method. We have a statistic-based method. So in the unsupervised clustering method, there are also methods that are based on more from clustering, from statistical series and models. Under those types, the other thing you may hear or you may use, being used a lot is called the Gaussian mixture models or GMM. You may see that term somewhere. So the idea of the Gaussian mixture models is actually quite similar with the k-means clustering. It just instead of we're trying to find k centers of k spatially distributed data, here what we want to do is we assuming our data coming from a composite distributions, then we can further decompose those distributions into k smaller Gaussian distributions and to describe them instead. So the algorithm, and there's actually share a lot of similarity with the k-means algorithm, but just one is more act on the distance based, and the other one is more act on the statistical distribution based. You want to assess which one is this particular data points is more statistically likely to be presented in this distribution rather than in other distributions. Okay. So I will skip the details here, but I have several slides that runs very nicely about how the algorithm actually works. So it's at the start, you may assume each one has the same distributions of your data. So for each of those data points, you basically can assume some parameters. And then after each iterations, and you are trying to adjust based on how the points actually distributed, given this distribution assumption, and to let them to fit better with your statistical parameters, and you do that adjustment. So this process is similar to the one I show as the one for the k-means where you see the cross move and whether you see the membership moving. It's the same thing, but you see the mean values, the mean point is moving, and then the statistical parameter is changing. So the one here is more from the green distribution, and one is more from the red distributions, and the other from more blue distributions. Okay. So again, the idea and the very similar, but the actual different principles and have a different suitabilities of the when it should be used. I have yes.
This model would be very good for composition, position and data, proportions or work with percentages.
Right. So now, so if you ask me, give you some general advice about when this one is more suitable, is usually we get our data from multiple data sources. There might be sometime we have assumption on this data, maybe more from a certain distribution. Like say we have this data set for our crops, and we have weather data, we have spatial data, we have some of the how people behave, and then the ultimately our outcome is how much crop we can yield per area. Right, so in that case, it might be a good scene to fit for here because each of those have some natural components and require a different model to model them. And we don't want to keep in one simple vectors to use something to describe them. So yeah, if that's what you mean by composite data, then that's exactly what this one could be good for. So you actually will find this cosmic model has more applicabilities in general because a lot of real cases, we can assume them as a composite distribution of many factors. Right? So if you are, so if you have some outcome, you think there's five different factors affecting them, those five factors may actually be governed by certain physical process, and each of the process have a certain statistical distributions that you might be able to use. But again, its name is a Gaussian model, so it's assuming they are Gaussian distribution, but just with a different set of parameters. So that's actually another limitation for it. Okay. So that's about all I know it's about, and I know I go through them very quick about supervised learning and unsupervised learning method. My exercise notebook has a lot of more information than my slides, but that's meant for you to explore more. So if you really want to learn more, I suggest you spending some time with my notebook. It's really good. It shows a lot of things, and I didn't explain here. I didn't know that. I didn't really have a chance to teach you. But yeah, so hopefully you get more time to practice. You won't easily get in that notebook out here, I can tell you that. So any question about the machine learning part, the supervised and unsupervised learning? Yes, okay.
So we saw both supervised and unsupervised techniques which of these and how they be scaled to use the larger
for big data? All the methods I mentioned here has a distributed version in MLDAV, so you can easily use that using the Spark to do the large scale distribution computations here. Again, I actually had a Zephyr notebook with those examples as well. So I think all the methods I'm introducing here, Spark has an implementation for you. What you can do is depends on if you're very familiar with the Python, and you can play with the second order. So that's what my Python example built on. If you want to scale up, second learn doesn't give you that choice. Second learn is a single thread implementations, but you can find in the same implementation, very similar interface, very similar API in the Spark, and you can use the Spark MLDAV to do those. And the method I introduced here, they all easy to be distributed, and Spark has existing implementations. You can come with your own implementations, but they all big data friendly analysis method. Any other questions? The second learn is really good. It's good for you to learn stuff and practice and experimenting with the smaller computers. But if you really get to larger scale, it's move to the Spark MLDAV. Okay, so the last big topics I need to cover is the deep learning side. So deep learning is really hot now, so you probably even see that from commercials, right? So maybe IBM has some deep learning cloud or NVIDIA is the stock being sky high in like 2 years is partly due to these things. So in the science, like I think most of us also doing science, is the deep learning is really good because it provides a new solution to many existing problems. Not only is a new solution, but it's a very effective solution. And so it's first being applied to the image classifications and speech recognition. So now if you have an iPhone or you have some kind of smart home device, you can talk to it. So at the backend is all the speech recognitions, and a lot of them are leveraging the learning processing sphere. It's being applied into the many of the domain science, really like from social science to astronomy to biology, and you can find the usage of the potential deep learning because it's just as a supervised learning method or unsupervised learning method, supervised learning machines, or so, and you can just throw a problem to it and to see what comes out. Okay. So what exactly is deep learning? And how many of you have that answer? So the short answer is a neural network with multiple layers, right? So you may heard that before. So like this is actually from one of my project. It's a traffic scene. So what we want to do is giving the a image from the videos and go through some magical neural network, and we can recognize, oh, here's a car, here's a person, and here's a bunch of cars waiting for the red lights, right? So from this sense, and it seems like machine learning, deep learning is nothing different than machine learning. And we want to build our model, so we want to use our model to make some predictions. But just in this case, the key ideas is not really based on like supported vector machines or statistically, but we want to be using a neural networks to do that, right? If you will look more closely, what's the difference between machine learning and deep learning, and why the machine learning and why deep learning getting so much attention is if you recall the picture I show you about supervised learning and unsupervised learning, we have real data, we have a step called the feature vectors, then we have the algorithm and the generative model. We call that part. So the feature vector is a small narrow part on top in each of pictures there. So that is typically what needed for the machine learning, right? Even if you recall my yesterday's lecture about the machine learning pipeline, we want to do assemblers, we have a certain pre-processing to selecting features, then use that one to it. So one of the actually very interesting thing about deep learning is trying to remove this process for you. So you can really just give an input, assuming it's the right format, so your code can read, can understand. And then the deep learning actually trying to find what's the best way to do the feature detection for the rest of your task, and then go back iteratively to make that one better. So in a sense, it's not only an improvement of the algorithm after you assess the given is a set of feature vector, but also algorithm trying to find to define what's the best set of vectors to be used to do that. So what when we talk about machine learning, I ask you what is being learned here, right? So for the deep learning, it's also a called like hierarchical representation learning. So it's learning the best way to representing your data in a hierarchical ways. Let's see for the traditional image classification, right? So given image, we need to hand cross some features to say here's a circle or here's a certain regions we want to do this, here's a certain vector we want to extract. But deep learning and through this process, it's trying to automatically do this for you by a mathematical transformation and to form what they call deep structures to form that hierarchical features. So that in the deep learning, you don't need to handcraft those features, but then each of the layer of the neural networks you give to it, it will generate a certain aspect of your data with certain features. So a successful neural network like ImageNet or ResNet, what they do is it's really to start with generating low-level local features, and then the computation goes through each layers of neural network. It go from lower level features and gradually to the higher level features, and then became a and then maps to the final classifiers. So for the features, you may not really make any sense of it, but at the end, this is an iterative process. But at the end, it can adjust how the features being constructed and being represented. So and ultimately gives you a very good result at the end. Any questions so far about the basic idea? Yes?
So you said deep learning can be used to both classify but also to select features.
Yes.
And it can be used only to select features, and these features can be used to classify using another technique, for example.
It's going to be really hard. I will explain that in a minute. But here is actual image being generated in some of the process. Can you make out anything what it's trying to do here or try to extract that? See, that's a problem. So That's also the advantage of deep learning, right? So when we do handcraft feature vectors, we are limited by our imaginations and by our comprehension. Basically, your brain capacity, how much you can consider it, and you get your knowledge there. But for the deep learning, it's just completely transform that into a brainless mathematical computations. So you could get a really good result at the end, but each intermediate layer for you is just maybe 10,000 numbers. It's very hard for you to use that, like single by one out and use that for the rest of the stuff. Any other questions? Okay. So what I mean by that is maybe like this can help you to understand better. So we mentioned deep learning, the core is a neural network, right? It's multiple layers, I'm trying to figure it out. So what's exactly a neural network? Neural network is the set of research in the computer science. It start maybe 1920s, it's very early. So it has been there for a while until recently deep learning make it so much more attention now. So the neural network is starts and even now is as a meaning of the biological process. It's actually a good model of how our brain or any life processing the information. So you have a certain neurons and a synapse and to get the stimulus from outside and then they are being combined together and the ultimate goes to your brain and you can make judgments, right? So you see something, you have a million cells in your eye to processing those individually, and they ultimately assemble the information within your brain to do that. So for the neural networks, it goes through the same process. So you have the input, and you have hidden layers, and then each input will make some contribution to each one of those units. And then the units will, based on the information it gathers, it will send a feedback to the next levels. And then ultimately, it may be mapped to certain output, like class labels, or a prediction, or inference layers. Okay. So that's sort of the ideas. Then from that ideas, and mathematically how people modeling them, again, it's actually go back to the simplest way we do is a linear regression. And we want to model them as a linear form. So if you take one of them, you have four inputs, and we can just assuming this is a the contribution of all the input to this one is a linear combination of it, right? But you notice a function here, so if the output is just W1 times X1 plus W2 times X2 all the way to W4 times X4, that would be exactly the same as a linear regression we talked about before. But now, interestingly, what you notice is that there's another function being on top of it, right? So it's not just a linear regression, but after linear regression, you want to do something. So that something is actually very important to deep learning how it can work. It calls an activation function. So it's basically to say we need some kind of filters, and if we blindly take all the information precisely as is, it might be too much information for us. So we may want to make some selection or some filtering out process. There are some commonly used activation functions. The one used a lot is called the recertified linear units, and it's basically, it's a fancy name, but it's actually just taking, if your output is a positive or negative, if it's negative, we just assume it's zero. Just ignore the negative thing, and we only take positive thing. Right, so there are other two other, sigmoid and time edge, and we can talk about that later. So now you see, it's a at the core is a linear combinations of the input and then to produce them, and then they add in a actual activation functions, and then so now all the information necessarily made to the end. Okay. So for the if we're using a RELU here, and what we essentially get just a maximum between zero and whatever the linear result we can get here. Then the sigmoid, also the softmax, and to trying to converting your a values in the real range into something more into a 0 to 1 range that can match to the probability score or confidence scores. So this is a like high-level view about a basic one-layer neural network, how it learns from input, finding a set of the ways to satisfy a set of linear equations, and then finding all those parameters and getting the power. So the sigmoid is the function is the one used for the softmax to mapping them, and the other activation function is the package. Here's REI view. Yeah. So they are all very simple mathematical functions, and they have a different usage. It's hard to tell you for CNN use this, and for RNN use this. It does, like for CNN people use REIU, for RNN people use TIH. It's hard to, I can tell you that, but it's hard for you to answer why without really finding and seeing, understanding the process. Okay. But the questions here, I want you to remember is why we need those activation functions. Why we just don't take the data combination. Okay. Any thoughts? Like why we are hiding the activation function from the result of even that each of them seems so simple as just take zero or positive one or just mapping them to this zero one unit. So recall one of the things we have been talking about when we talk about support vector machines. I mentioned it's a very popular method right before the deep learning comes to the horizons. Why is that? It's because it can help you dealing with nonlinear relatives. Because nonlinear relationship is the one we actually encounter the most for our practical problems. Our practical problem is actually very hard to be modeled just as a bunch of linear combinations. So that's exactly what activation function does, is adding that layer of nonlinearities needed to simulating the complex representation of the data. So it's actually very simple. It's just say, sometimes I just don't consider these activations, and sometimes I do consider that. But the result will be, give you a more refined representations of your say, classification boundaries and layers. So the more neurons you added, because each one has a different activation function, each one became a parameters of your neural network as well, so you can have better classifier boundaries being built than just a linear combinations. So as you can see, like the more complex the neural network it is, and then the more accurate or more effective they generally became. So this is just from the ImageNet classification examples. From the 2010, when the first deep learning first being come as a useful method, and they only using 28, using a small number of layers, and then later on, and now like the best one give you the minimum of the errors, they're using more than like 150 layers and just do the deep learning optimizations. Okay. So definitely more layers it makes things better, but on the other hand, is the more layer you have, the more computation you needed, and these things became more complex, right? So, for example, go back to our simple example is we have four inputs, and then we need to just do the linear combinations. Each one will have four weights, and then for each one of them, they will have a bias values and two pair. Then the softmax will have another one. So we're essentially looking for, you can isolate this, there's a 16 plus 4 plus 1 and plus another 5, the 25 parameters just for these simple models. If you have 152 and if you have say 100 inputs, then that number quickly multiplies. Okay. But that's still the ideas of this, right, of the neural networks. So how we can learn all those parameters from the training data set, okay? So the general process is similar like what we deal with k-means. We have iterative process. We start with something random, then we make the process work, then make the process eventually convert into optimal solutions. This is same thing we're doing with the neural network here. Just in this case, we start with the initially set of random weights with all those parameters. It could be say 0.1. Then we let it run to see how prediction result it is. Then from that prediction result, we can calculate the errors. You see, here's so much errors from this set of weights. Then now we can do through a process we call bite propagations, and we can say if we want to minimize these errors, and how we should adjust our weights from the end to the beginning, and to minimize those errors. So the next iteration, when we update the weights, we're getting less errors. And then we can repeat this process until the overall error base drop under certain threshold. Yes?
Which is a nice threshold for the error?
That's actually more problem specific. So you have a number of things, you have a number of iterations you want to run, and you also have an absolute threshold at the end you want your network to convert into. And there's not a single really, so there is a single threshold on converting threshold, but there are also many other parameters that also contribute to the process. Is that your question?
Yeah, but in general, one should say 80% is okay for not.
No. It's a matter of the changing, not the 80% of accuracies. So the converging is, so that's actually what this slide is trying to show. The converging is, when we say the converging is more like how much we can improve over the previous iteration, not really how much accuracy we can achieve. Right? So we may not be able to achieve 80% even when you design that. But for this, given your networks, given this method, 70% is the maximum we can get because we run 1,000 iterations. There's just no way we can use those. So the conversion, when I say that, the threshold, this refers to the difference between current iteration versus previous iteration. Okay, so the back propagation, the implementation is called using a method called gradient descent. So it's basically you can view in them as a process of finding a optimize point along your error surface. So this graph you see here, if like in the three dimension, so the vertical one here is your errors, and then you have assuming you only have two contributing factors, so for two different weights, and so when you're choosing the different values, you may reach different errors. Right, so if you reach for a certain combinations, your error may be certain value along that surface here. So if, even for the multiple weights, we can have a hyper dimension and we'll have a hyper surface to correspond to this error surface. So eventually what the batch propagation trying to achieve is to work around this error surface, find out the lowest points. It cannot always find out the lowest points, but it will try with the given each given iterations. With each runs, and that's sort of how it goes. To, along here, we are going to find out the combination that can give us the worst errors out. So in the practice, there are a set of learning. In the practice, the computation of this process is very complex and very complicated. It can be even more complicated if you have deeper neural network structures and a lot of parameters that's input. So in the practice, the learning is actually done in batch. So you have, say, 10 million input data you want to learn. They cannot be learned at the same time because that input will be too much for the data, for the algorithm. So they group them into each individual batch, so say 256 or 128 or whichever numbers. So each batch will learn a set of weights, and then the next batch will do that again. So there's a number of parameters associated with that entire process. So you may hear something like an epoch, which means when we go through all the input once, so that maybe go through many batch, many type of learning process already. And the learning rate is how much you want to cut each time when you want to reduce error. So if you get higher learning rate, it may be converting faster, but it may have a better, higher chance to miss the optimal solutions for use. Then you have a mini batch size, so each input samples, how big it is. The bigger might, again, might give you more coarse resolutions, but may help you to run the program quicker. And the epoch is a thing I just mentioned, it's a time of which each sample has been visited because we need to break them into different batch to do that. The example is 100 millions. If we have 512 image per batch, then the epoch we will need like 2400 iterations to learn the iterations for that. So there's a lot of other parameters to go with it as well. Some of them is a particular case trying to address the overfitting and underfitting problems. So that's is a very like a big concern in the deep learning is if you give a very complex neural network but a relatively simple set of training data set, or your training data set is not big enough, they actually may be able to find a solution to exactly describing your training data set. This set of parameters actually works perfect for this. But that may not mean it has a general applicabilities. So that's what this figure trying to show. On here is your training effort. Think about like the cost of your trainings. And on here is your model complexities. And then here is your error on the testing data set. So you may say spending a lot of time, like a lot of computational power, or make your model really complex. Eventually, you can reduce your training data set really, training error really low. But there would be some crossover point where your testing accuracy will not be no longer jump along with your training accuracy there. So this part is underfitting, this part is overfitting. So a lot of parameters and the ways in the deep learning neural networks is trying to help you to find out what's exactly the perfect optimal fitting points as well. So there's some general concept with the deep learning, and then there comes with a set of the different neural networks layers and the architectures. I want to maybe introduce one is called autoencoders. It's a simple one, and it's my it's easier for you if you just start to learn the concept of this. Okay? So for the autoencoders, it's really like an encoding process. Right? So here we have a two-dimensional data points. If we save all of them, and then we may need to save each individual point, so that's not how they storage to do. But if we know they are forming certain relationships, then we can only return some part of values and not entirely all of those. So the autoencoders is based on the ideas, and we just want basically like for your given data set, like image, we want to find out a hash code for that. So later on we can say for this image we are working with this hash code, and that hash code can then be, through the reverse neural network, can be used to reconstruct your image. So it's kind of like compression, right? So we compress the data into a certain coding, the data can be constructed. So that's the idea about autoencoders. I have a couple of the slides for the mathematics. I think I will skip them. So just jump on to the autoencoder examples. So that's, I have the AE IPython notebook uploaded in the materials there. You can also find it in my slash work directory, just in case this Jupyter notebook doesn't work. So for these examples, notebooks here. Is there anyone on the Jupyter Club right now? So if you are on the Jupyter Club right now, or if not, you need to remember this command. Basically, this is an exponential point, which means we are going to call a system command through the Jupyter Club. And then you can add in tool and install the network users. And what it will install is a three package. The TensorFlow package, which is a deep learning framework, and then the Keras, which is another deep learning framework built on top of TensorFlow, and the Keras.dataset, so which we need that for to retrieve the data sets here. Okay. Later, I can make posting that line as well. So my notebook was intended to be used with our machine learning resources, so we already have TensorFlow and Keras installed there. But for the virtual machines, we do not have that. But once you do this pip install, and it will start downloading a background stuff and do the installation for you. Once it's done, you need to go back to kernels and do a restart kernels and to make it to take it back there. Okay? And you, for this case, you just keep it and have some two kernels. If you are able to, just copy this command and let it run now, and then, or you can try them later. But once we, so what the rest of the code does is it's a long notebook. First is loading minced data site for testing. So the minced data site, like the digital data site we use for the PCA denoising results, so you will see something like this if you run successfully. So the data site you are using is a minced data site, is about handwritten character recombinations. So each of them is a small image block, it's a 28 by 28. And then the minced data set consists of 60,000 training data set and 10,000 for the passing image as well. They both are available in there and you can run them. So let me go down here. So this is basically the sentence style. It's a goal, though you not means that except the testings. And I have a third one to show some of the results of it. So it's a looks like this. It's a 6,000 for the training design, 6,000 for testing design. Each image exactly looks like this. And you can use a different image to show them. Then I have examples of a very simple autoencoders with a single lens layers. So this code, because we are using Keras make deep learning development much easier. We don't have time to go through the details with the API, but basically what we're doing here is we have the encoding dimensions, so that's a goal we want to reach, so we want to it's an autoencoder, so we want to encode it into some type of hash code. So the 32 is a dimension of the hash code we are trying to achieve. So after that, general thing to define the input shapes of the bit frames. And then we want to make one dense layers, and using that encoding dimensions, and using these particular activation functions, and apply to this set of input data. Then that we finish defining them. And for the decoder, it's the same and the reverse, but we're using a different activation function here. Okay? Then it's a similar process. We put our autoencoder, we put the different layers in the model, so then you can call that model, and you can find it. So if you write this block successfully, your summary of the models, you have a input layers, so that's where your data comes in. It has a dimension of 784, so that's a result of 28 by 28, so that's 100 pixels. Each of those little image types, so that's your input dimensions. And for the dense layers, we basically want to say from this many of the vectors, we want to set up, you want to be mapping them into a certain dimension of vectors. So that was this dense layer about. So this is the number of parameters to hard for that type. Then for the decoders, we will have an input of the 32 dimension of the code as an input. Then in turn, we want to generate a 784 dimension of the vectors of the as an output. So the result is a training process. If you run that line, you will see something like this. So this is each iteration is trying to do. So you see the epoch being seen here. So here we want to do at least a 10 epoch, which means we want the training process go through all the data at least a few times. To define the batch size, maybe 256. You feel free to change all those values and to see if there's any effect. And they will report the loss functions and the value appears at the zone at the end. It will stop either after the your data is stopped after the part about the pumps you specify. So here's an output for the input. Input image looks like this. And this is reconstruct image, which means go through our one single layer density decoders. We IP each of them into a 32-bit code. Then from that code, if we go to a reverse, this is the things we can better identify. Okay. So till here, that's the basics about a how to encoders, right? So in this case, we only have one layer. We basically tell the for the input of a 28 by 28 image, now generating a 32 coding for that. Then using that coding schema, we can give an input, we can reconstruct a 784 for 28 by 28 image back. Okay, so any questions about this? Okay, so let me go back to my slides. So my slides is actually is just has some documents about what I was just saying, the single thing there are examples, what we are doing here, and what we are trying to mic in, and this is the result of the micings. So for this case, we were just doing single layers, and you can add in additional layers on top of it. If you scroll down the notebook a few blocks more, you will see I have an example where we put three layers of the cosmic like deep encoders, and we can have multiple layers and trying to do encode. Now, not directly from 784 to 32, but in this case, we go from 784 to 128. Then to 64, then to 32 here. So we have three density layer to reach the 32. Then the decoding is exactly the reverse process. So that constitutes the density layers. It has a significant more amount of parameters it needed to learn and to write. Okay. So one of the things you can use autoencoder directly, you can use them for a number of things. One is you can use them as an index, because in this case, the encode, the hash code, is something you can directly see and you can directly use. And the other thing you can, people can use, is use it as a noise filter as well, because when you, it's a similar idea with the PCA. When you choose a subset of the components, you capture the mean, in part and similar input this side. And here, the autoencoder is also encoding the majority information of your input data. But so a lot of noise points may be filtered out eventually by the process. So in the notebook, I have some further examples to show how it can be used as a denoising filters. So in these examples, we start with a little data side. We actually manually add in a lot of Gaussian noise in the image, so the image looks not so clean. You see all those little white dots we are adding to it. But if we train our data with a clean image, and then we give a noisy inside to it, it actually can do a good job to ignore the noise and reconstruct the clean image. Yes. Yes, yes. No. No, this parameter is useful for this set of data because we actually have a 60,000 image and each image is 784 vectors. So for the at least for the parameters we're using here, it's okay. You can the other thing you can see is the deep autoencoder for this case it's actually not that effective compared to the single layer. So they basically perform the same. So that's another cue to tell you we probably need more data for it to work better as well. Yeah. So your concern is a crime. So the more parameter, the more complicated data you want to use, the network you want to use, you need more data to make it meaningful. But on the other hand, is what you will get is you may get some redundant layers, some layers less effective that you probably just want to get rid of them. So there does exist in some kind of correlation. The more data you have, the more complex the network you have, you can get a better result. Just getting complex network without the substantial data to backing it up, you won't be able to get a good result. So autoencoder is a simple example to show off the deep learning structures and the process. I have a number of more slides. I'm thinking to do it now or the way it's time for lunch or we can another 2 minutes. So in the deep learning, feel bad let you go before let you know what's a CNN, what's a RFN, ATIS. So that's the two most commonly used neural network structures. So in the previous stage, when we just mentioned a dense layer, which is just a strictly a combination of input and output, the convolution of neural network is very interesting. It's not just the do that, right? It's apply a convolutional layer to it. So in part, is also trying to do is it's trying to reduce the number of parameters required to be learned. So that's exactly also address the question you were mentioning. So the reason we have such high number of parameters is because we need to treat each input like 74 as a unit of input dimension. So that's multiplied up. If we can quickly reduce our input dimensions, we can reduce the subsequent parameters we need to learn. So even now, in my notebook, there's an example of the other deep autoencoder. There's an example where we are not just using dense layer, but using a convolutional layers in between them. So you will see that one has a smaller number of parameters you need, and it's kind of equally effective. So one of the ideas of the convolutional layers is act as a filters. So the convolutional layers is a kind of a very small matrix. So in these examples, it's actually in a 3x3 matrix. So what it does is acts as a filters. Like this is your original image, but eventually each image is a bitmap. So it's represented by some type of values. And then you can apply your filters all across your image. Then what you get depends on how you define your filters. It's actually generating some useful features out of it. So for this particular one, what it does is just trying to highlight the lines, structures inside your image here. So that's what the convolutional layers trying to do. It acts as a little windows, goes through your image or goes through your input, and it will generate a more like the matrix consists of more of your local layers. So convolution, the name is a corresponding to a mathematical operation in here. It's a function transformation operations that's given to matrix. It's actually very similar to the multiplications. So here, what it shows is you have an input, this is your original image, and this is the convolutional filters, which also refer as the kernels. And then you have the original data and the A, B, C, E, F here, and your kernel has a certain weight. And then you do a matrix multiplications, and then you can get in a new matrix with this result. So your input will be a 4x3, and your output will be a 3x2. So it's a slightly shifting between your input and output due to the edge effect. Okay. So this is actual computations about how it works. So this is original matrix, and this is your convolutional filters you want to apply. So it's act as a sliding windows, go through them, and the generating is 3x3. So your real input is 5x5, now it's became a 3x3. There's other ways you can make it as the same dimension as your original one, but normally it's called Python process. Normally that is it's used in some cases. So one thing the convolutional features, so two things convolutional features does is to generating a getting some aspect of your features from your image. So for example, for this image, so this is real black-white image, and if you apply a simple kernel like this, you get the outlines of the animals rather than the details of the animals. So it gives you some higher level localized features. And the other thing it does is comparing to the dense layers. So one thing you notice is we need a huge amount of parameters because there are a huge amount of computation. So if we apply the convolutions, it's much smaller steps, much smaller computations to reconstructing this type of memory. Okay. And the other things about the convolutional neural network is usually when we say convolutional layers, it consists of not filters we apply through your original input matrix, but also followed by a pooling stage where we further shrinking the matrix input size. So the pooling is really just to say if I want to do a 2x2 for pooling, we want to just consider our matrix as a 2x2 block, and for the 2x2 block, I have different choice. If I do the max poolings, I will just look at these 2x2 blocks and report the maximum values within these 2x2 blocks. So this will be, say, if I do max pooling, this block will convert into a 4, and this block will convert into a 5, and this block will convert into a 3, and this one convert into a 4. So when we say the convolutional layers, usually it's considered of a kernel, which is small filters, 3x3, 4x4, 5x5, that can help you to focusing on certain features we want to detect. Then followed by a max pooling layers, that are trying to aggregate those things and to emphasize that signals, local signals out. Okay. So the pooling helps reduce complexities, but also helps emphasize these local features we want to identify, so that makes the whole model can be nice affected by different orientation of the image. So the local translation is a big problem with the image recognitions. What we mean by that is before the deep learning, before we have a way to handle the translation, the file writing like this way and the file writing like this way is very hard to be considered the same. But with the convolutional layer, it's pooling, and what we are trying to represent is the local features. Like there's a small curve here, there's a small line here, there's a small line there. So that can make the models more invariant to those local translations. So that's a big factors contribute to why deep learning is so good and so much effective when applied to the image recognition problems. So here are some more examples. I can skip this. And this is another example about the mixed data set. So that's a data set we use for the autoencoders. This is one of the papers for the LE9 proposal. So you can find the papers. I should have a reference somewhere. But it's a fairly simple neural networks. It's easier to understand. So they starting with the convolutional layers with the 5x5 filters. So they have 6 layers of it. So that's how we want to do. Basically want to say we want to try to find in 6 different features that we can extract it by the convolutional layers. Then you go through a subsampling, which is pooling layers, and then you go through from initially 32x32 input. After your convolutional layer filters, you get 28x28. then you do a GUI and you get a 40 by 40, so it's two to one samples. Then you can apply the convolutions to these layers again and do the pooling again. Then you do a dense fully connected layers and do the mapping them back and mapping them, eventually mapping them into the class labels, which is each individual characters. So the other very commonly used neural network structure is the RNN. It stands for recurrent neural networks. It's even more complex than the convolutional neural network. Now, convolutional neural network is only the significant contribution is just introducing the kernel functions and the pulleys. What the RNN is trying to resolve is the limitation of the convolutional neural networks by be able to take a streaming data or a sequence of the data. So what's RNN was commonly used for modeling a sequence info. So some example people doing is trying to automatically comes with a caption to describe what this video sequence people trying to do. Say a person riding a bike up there. So if you are using YouTube and use some of the captions is written by people, like explanations, but this method can help to automatically generating those descriptions for this video or what this sequence about. The other usage in the NLP is to use it to activate through sentimental analysis according to your entire documents, but not by single individual words. And also the RNN has been used a lot in the machine translations as well. So that's the type of the use case for the recurrent neural networks. So if you think about it in an abstract way, for the neural networks, we can think about like input, head layers, and to the output. For the output encoders, the output will be coding or it can be come back. For the convolutional neural networks, we just have a special operations inside the hidden layers here. So that's all the same. But for the RNN, what's the difference is we want to model this over a sequence. So we can apply this to not data from one time point, but for the time 0, time 1, time 3. So we want to keep that effect that can be applied to the next timing steps. So if you wrote that network, so that network has this kind of feedback loop, which essentially to say some of things I learned from the first frame will be carried over to the next frame when I try to do the analysis. When you draw that over time, what you get is at time zero, it looks like a simple neural network. I have input, I have output, but some of the output will be carried over when you do the next round of analysis. And then again, you carry over to the next round of analysis, and then all the way to the end. So they have this kind of the history they are trying to capture. So how long that history capture? Is a difference between different parameters and different networks it's trying to do. So RNN is much more complex neural networks. So I will just give you the introduction here, and if you get a chance to use it, you need another week of lecture to talk about more detail with different things. So I will end my lecture basically here. But this is a very fascinating graphs I found. I have a URL at the beginning. It's just we capture different type of the neural networks architectures out there, right? So you see, it's not just the autoencoders, perceptrons, multi-layer perceptrons, CNN and RNN. There are a lot of other neural networks architectures people try to propose and try to be applied to the each individual cases. So yeah, it's a little bit of a rush to the rest of the content, but deep learning itself is an upcoming field, and by itself it deserves a week lectures to give you a full understanding about usefulness, limitation, and how you can use it. Okay, so but for today, I'm going to stop here. Any questions you want to ask now? Or my autoencoder notebook has an example up to the denoising filters. So please go ahead to play with it and let me know if you have more questions. That's all.
Volvemos entonces 1:15 para tener exactamente una hora para la marcha.
Wait, yeah.